handouts that you got is the material that I would like to cover tonight. I don't know if we'll get all the way through it. As you can see, it deals with the periods which biblical scholars would generally term the intertestamental period. That is the period from the end of the exile, the Babylonian exile, up until the beginning of the Roman period, or that period which defines the end of the writing of the Old Testament and lies before the beginning of the New Testament writing. Technically, that's a misleading term because there are, in fact, some books, at least most scholars would say, like the book of Daniel, which probably was produced during the Hellenistic period or during the so-called New Testamental period. You can see the chart is simplified. It has the names of most of the important rulers of the Babylonians, Persians, Ptolemies, Seleucids, and so forth. And we'll follow this in the lecture, just pointing out some of the major events that took place, and again, citing some of the archaeological evidence that relates to the biblical stories. Okay, we left off last time talking about the beginning of the so-called Babylonian exile, the destruction of Jerusalem by Nebuchadnezzar in 587. Remember that when we talk about the Babylonian exile or the deportation and define it in terms of 587, that's a bit misleading because, in fact, the Babylonians had attacked Jerusalem in 598 and taken exiles at that point. 587 again, taking exiles. 587 was the big destruction of Jerusalem. But then again, they returned in 582, attacked Jerusalem again, took more exiles, and at the same time attacked Ammon and Moab, and we think probably took Ammonites and Moabites into exile as well. In the immediate period that follows, it seems that Ammon and Moab, this side of the Jordan Valley, or the Jordan River, was more or less depopulated, not because everybody was carried off into exile, but it appears as if fairly large groups of Ammonites and Moabites moved across the river onto the West Bank. You see evidence of that in the biblical text itself, which talks about the post-exilic period, one of the problems being a lot of intermarriage between the Jews, the Ammonites, and Moabites, something which the more conservative Jewish leaders were very opposed to. Also, Ammonites and Moabites probably did the same thing that we know certain Jews did, and that was fled to the east, or fled to the south, and established colonies in Egypt. Unlike the treatment that the exiles from the northern kingdom received at the hands of the Assyrians, you'll remember that when the northern kingdom, Samaria, fell in 722, the northerners were taken off into exile in Assyria, and the official policy was to scatter the exiles as broadly as possible across the empire, to transplant peoples from other parts of the empire into the northern kingdom, and thus to try to promote the assimilation of different cultural groups as rapidly as possible. And that is what seems to have happened to the so-called 10 lost tribes of Israel. They simply assimilated with other people in different parts of the Assyrian Empire. The Babylonians, on the other hand, had quite a different policy, and that is they allowed and even encouraged the exiles from the southern kingdom, or Judah, to live together, stay together, to carry on their culture and religion. Of course, in the case of the Judahites, and I might mention that this is the point at which the term Jew comes into vogue. They were referred to in the Babylonian exile as Yahudi, simply meaning the descendants of the kingdom of Judah. And it's only once you get into the Babylonian exile that the term Jew comes into vogue. Therefore, it's an anachronism, really, to refer to Abraham as being a Jew. He's not a Jew. Nobody of the Hebrew extraction or religion is a Jew until the time of the Babylonian exile. And on the other hand, it's a bit of an anachronism to say that people during the exile or afterwards or today are Israelites. The Israelites lived during the time, either in the time of David and Solomon, under the United Monarchy, or you could call a member of the Northern Kingdom from the time of the death of Solomon to 722, a citizen of the Northern Nation of Israel could be referred to as an Israelite. But there is no such thing as a modern Israel. Okay, although the Jews at this point now were allowed to live together, to practice the cultural practices and religion they were used to, of course that wasn't possible when it came to religion, because religion had always centered around the temple worship service, of which the sacrificial system was a very important part. With the so-called Deuteronomic Reformation, which had taken place under King Josiah around 620, emphasis was placed on the centralization of the cult in Jerusalem. It was pointed out that Jerusalem was the only place that you could sacrifice. Therefore, with the exile, the destruction of the temple, it became unlawful, according to Jewish law, to make sacrifices in any other place. Therefore, there was a certain need to improvise, and it's almost certain that it was during the Babylonian exile that the institution of the synagogue was raised. If you aren't near the temple, you can't sacrifices to Yahweh. You still have to meet and worship in some context, and it was probably at that point that the synagogue arises, and also at that point that the scriptures, which were being collected by people probably like Ezra, who was concerned that the people might lose their Jewish religious identity, that the scriptures were being pulled together and became the focus of the synagogue worship, whereas before it had been the sacrificial system. One thing that you find near the end of the Babylonian exile, and remember that doesn't last very long, just referring to your chart here, if you define the last deportation as being 582, Babylon falls in 539. So it's a rather short period that the Jews are in Babylon. Right near the end of that period, around 540, maybe 545, you find a kind of revival of hope, a hope of return to Jerusalem. And the one prophet who expresses that perhaps more profoundly than anybody is so-called Second Isaiah, or the prophecies that are contained in the book of Isaiah, chapter 40 through 55. With Isaiah, you find a strong element of messianic hope. We should perhaps say something about that. The Hebrew term, ancient Hebrew term, for the king was the anointed one. You remember the story of how Samuel anoints Saul, and then later he anoints David to be the king. So the king is called the one who is anointed. The Hebrew word for that was Messiah. So every ancient Hebrew king was referred to as God's Messiah, in other words, God's king over Judah or Israel. After the death of Solomon, just recall briefly the history of both the northern and the southern kingdom. It was very rocky. There was a lot of corruption, a lot of syncretism with other neighboring religions. And more you got this hope expressed for an ideal Messiah that would come and reestablish an ideal reign similar to that practiced by David and Solomon. You find in the later period, certainly up into the exilic period, that with the fall of Jerusalem, that messianic hope is almost completely dashed. Especially since a lot of people felt that Yahweh actually lived in the temple physically, and that the destruction of the temple meant that Yahweh's abode had been destroyed. So by the end of the exile, though, where it looks on the horizon that Cyrus the Persian is rising in power, the fall of Babylon appears to be imminent, you find people like 2 Isaiah reviving that messianic hope, saying that we are going to return to Jerusalem. Yahweh will establish his Messiah to rule over Jerusalem. He talks about the return from the exile, not only as being a second exodus, much better than the first exodus coming up from Egypt, but he talks about it in very eschatological, almost apocalyptic terms. That is, 2 Isaiah doesn't simply say that, well, the time is going to come when we will be delivered and be able to walk back to Jerusalem, but he says when that time comes, the desert is going to be transformed, there will be rivers going through the desert, be a total transformation of both the wilderness and Jerusalem when we get there. If you are familiar with Handel's Messiah, you might recognize the fact that the first few songs in there are taken almost directly out of Isaiah chapter 4, that talks about every hill laid low and every valley exalted. One other interesting thing that 2 Isaiah does, it, no other prophet or author in the Old Testament does, is he refers to the pagan, Cyrus, the Persian emperor, as being God's Messiah. I believe that's chapter 45, the first verse, which is a very strange thing, usually, and especially at this period, as Judaism is becoming more and more turned in on itself. There's hardly anything that's ever good that's said about a Gentile. But Isaiah breaks with that tradition, referring to Cyrus as Yahweh's anointed, his Messiah who is coming to liberate the Israelites. Okay, as far as the archaeological evidence is concerned, you do see a marked decrease in population here in Transjordan and in Palestine as well, right around the period that we would expect to find it, that is, after the destruction of Jerusalem from about 580 on. It doesn't appear as if city life is flourishing in either Palestine or Transjordan as it had been previously. There is still pottery remains. Certainly not everybody fled the country, but it does seem that city life was rather radically affected. Some people have suggested that there may have been as many as 50,000 exiles. That's probably quite an exaggeration. Jeremiah himself says that there were only about 850. But in any case, a lot of people would say that there were only approximately 20,000 people left in the land. So you do find evidence of occupation, but certainly not evidence of intensive occupation as you had earlier in the Iron Age. Okay, the post-exilic period, that is the period right after the exile, starts with the fall of Babylon in 539. Cyrus the Great, the Persian emperor, conquered Babylon, in a sense not in a drawn-out battle at all. In fact, he walked into Babylon without meeting any resistance. And in 538, he issued an edict, which is also, we have the actual edict on an old clay cylinder, as well as quotes from it in the book of Ezra. In this edict, Cyrus said that any of the foreign captive peoples in Babylon were free to return to their homeland. Not only were they free to return to their homelands to worship as they had done before Babylonian domination, but Cyrus even made funds from the Persian government available for that purpose. That's quite a difference, and it certainly would account for the very friendly view that the Bible has toward Cyrus as opposed to the way in which Babylon and Assyria are portrayed. A although Cyrus was a very powerful military force, he was evidently perceived by most of the people he conquered as being more of a liberator than a conqueror, because he did have this practice of allowing people to maintain their national identity, to propagate their indigenous worship services and so forth, whereas it had been the explicit policy of both the Babylonians and the Assyrians to try to get people to assimilate or to try to get them involved in the national cult of the empire. You might think that that edict of Cyrus would have had a tremendous impact on the exiles, that they all would have gone flocking back to Palestine, especially if you read certain of the Psalms where they're lamenting, how can we worship Yahweh in a strange land, and so forth. In fact, it was a rather disappointing experience, because even though they had been in, the exiles had been in Babylon for a very short period, they had been treated fairly decently, certainly compared with Assyrian standards. And quite a number of them, it would appear from books such as Ezekiel, refused to go back to Jerusalem. They were well established where they were, and they preferred to stay in Babylon rather than to return to the country. Those who did return to Judah were also strongly disappointed. First of all, as they went through the desert, it had not been transformed into a paradise the way 2 Isaiah had said it would. They got back to Jerusalem not to have a grand entry into the glorious city, but the city was completely in ruins, barely occupied. The countryside was devastated, very poor. And although Cyrus had provided funds and given permission for the rebuilding of the temple, and work was started, the work on the temple proceeded very, very slowly, until finally, around between 520 and 515, there was a burst of energy, a lot of effort put into the temple, and it was finally completed around 515. So, a number of years after the people had returned. I should also mention that the return from exile was not one large mass movement, but there seems to have been different waves of people that returned at different times. In the New Testament, you run across a group of people called the Samaritans. Perhaps the most familiar story involving a Samaritan is Jesus' parable of the Good Samaritan, the Samaritan who took care of the fellow who had fallen among the thieves. In order to understand who the Samaritans are, you have to go back to this intertestamental period. When the Jews had come out of exile, returned to Jerusalem, they were met by the so-called Samaritans, who came from, obviously, Samaria, in the north, came down to the exiles to welcome them home and to offer to help them in the rebuilding of the temple. This is a point at which you find the tensions starting, or at least a lot of scholars would say they started tracing back further than that. But in any case, the Jews who had been in exile considered the Samaritans to be half-breeds, religiously unclean, because they were the descendants of the Israelites of the northern kingdom. And after the fall of Samaria, and the Assyrians had brought foreigners in, these Israelites had mixed, intermarried with people of different races. And although they retained their Israelite or Yahwistic faith, the southerners felt that they were impure because of this intermarriage. That's at least the impression you get from both the books of Nehemiah and Ezra. In fact, I think you can trace it back much further than that. As soon as the two kingdoms divided after the death of Solomon, from that point on, the southerners always felt that the northerners were schismatic because they did not recognize the Davidic line, and they did not worship in the temple of Jerusalem. So in a sense, I think you have to go back to the death of Solomon to understand who the Samaritans are, but certainly this all came to a head when the exiles had come back, the Samaritans offered to help them build the temple, and their offer was refused by the recently returned exiles. Ultimately, around 350 BC, the Samaritans themselves established their own temple on Mount Gerizim, right near modern-day Nablus. And of course, that's the setting there for the story of Jesus and then going at the Samaritan woman at the well and the debate over where should you worship, on Mount Zion or Mount Gerizim. Okay, although the temple was finally rebuilt in 515, again, the returnees were disappointed because it wasn't anything like the temple had been during the time of Solomon. And with a lot of your prophets, Jeremiah, but especially again, Isaiah among them, the people's hopes had been raised so high that once they got back, the city would be rebuilt, the Davidic ideal Messiah would rule over the people again, and instead they ended up with a rather shabby little temple, nothing like it had been in the days of Solomon. And even after the construction of that temple in 515, it wasn't until approximately 65 years later that any attempt was made to try to rebuild the wall of Jerusalem. So you can kind of picture what the situation was like, people living in fairly poor conditions. The temple has been rebuilt on a very modest scale, but certainly Jerusalem was not returning to its former glory.
How large was the original temple?
Not really. By, you know, I couldn't give you right off the top of my head the exact measurements. But it certainly wouldn't be. It depends. You know, there's three different temples, essentially. There's the Solomonic temple, then there's this second temple. Then finally, Herod the Great starts rebuilding the temple in 18 BC, and that goes on for some 50 years. And the final temple that was completed after the death of Christ turned out to be much larger and much more elaborate than the Solomonic temple. But this temple, in the meantime, was very small. I doubt if the temple that was rebuilt at this time was much larger than this house. It certainly wouldn't be as high as this house. It would be a little longer. Yeah.
Is there
Last mention of the Ark of the Covenant is with the destruction of Jerusalem in 587. There's no more mention of it. And again, there is an old tradition, and it's strange. Now, absolutely nothing is said in any of the biblical books about the fate of the Ark of the Covenant. It's assumed either that it was destroyed or that the Babylonians carried it off with booty. There is a passage in the book of Maccabees which talks about Jeremiah taking the Ark of the Covenant and hiding it on Mount Nebo, and that deserves for a lot of the folks that come over and look on Mount Nebo for the Ark of the Covenant. But there are a number of other pseudepigraphal books, that is, books that were, say, supposedly written by Moses, although they were actually written by somebody in the Hellenistic period, talking about the Ark of the Covenant and a number of different subjects. But there's very, very little likelihood that any of those sources have any historical validity. There's legends, stories that circulated trying to explain, you know, whenever you get something like that, the Ark disappeared with no explanation, inevitably somebody is going to come along and try to explain what actually happened to it. But from the biblical data itself, we have absolutely no idea. I think there is another tradition, it's not in Maccabees, but that Jeremiah hid it in the area of the Temple Mount.
Have the archaeologists really found the foundation of the second temple?
You know, I haven't been over on the other side, so it's really difficult for me to evaluate what has or hasn't been found. I'm always skeptical, though, because it's just like the stories of the discovery of the Ark of the Covenant. Those types of things come out periodically in very regular fashion, just like the stories of having found the Second Temple or walls of Solomonic Temple. But so far, even though there are a number of reports like that, they all, after a certain time, turn out to be false or misreading of the date of the walls. So I just one good question.
But the historicity of the Second Temple, the Ascanus, and the
I think there's really no question that it must have been built. But again, this is one of those points when it comes to archaeological confirmation is missing. We don't have any archaeological evidence for the Solomonic Temple, either, which would have been a much more massive building. But again, in Jerusalem, there has been so much destruction and rebuilding and reusing of stones that it's very understandable why structures like Solomon's Temple or the Second Temple would be built. But it's just hard to imagine historically that anybody would make up a story about the rebuilding of the Second Temple, especially when the biblical books themselves reflect the disappointment of the people. The fact that it was rebuilt, that people really weren't that excited about it because it wasn't that grand a building. The stories of the great building anyway. Question, Mr. Wilson. Yeah, Josephus would be the one that would quickly spring to mind. Well, Josephus does. But I don't know, because he has a vested interest being Jew himself. I don't know of any of the pagan scholars that talk about this. Again, it just depends on how you evaluate the evidence. The Bible itself would certainly indicate that Solomon's Temple and Herod's Temple were great, massive, marvelous buildings. I think, that might be a fairly prejudiced evaluation, whether the Temple of Solomon or even Herod was that much more impressive than other major temples, say, of the Persians. Doubt that anything in Jerusalem ever lived up to what the Persians created or what the Babylonians created in Babylon in terms of its massive size and splendor and so forth. But it's hard to tell. I mean, we just don't have any traces. Okay, according to the biblical tradition, then, Jeremiah, who was serving as a cupbearer of the Persian emperor, probably Artaxerxes I, although there's debate on this as well as whatever, heard about the fate of Jerusalem, how although the people had returned, things were still very dismal, the city wall had not been rebuilt. And so, around 445, and that's, I didn't put about or C or CA on any of these dates, although I hope you understand all of them are questionable, at least within a few years. Sometime around 445, Nehemiah did persuade the Persian emperor to send him to Jerusalem with the authority of a governor so that he could rebuild the city wall. Along with trying to rebuild the city wall, Jeremiah also tried to initiate some religious reforms, evidently ran into some problems, perhaps because he wasn't a trained theologian. In any case, he sent word back to the Persian king to send a Jewish theologian who could oversee the religious reforms that he wanted to carry out as he was undertaking these political reforms. Now again, that's very debatable. There's a lot of question as to how many times Ezra who was the theologian that was sent, how many times he came to Jerusalem, if he came before Nehemiah or if Nehemiah came before him. What's the essential thing to remember is that basically Nehemiah was the one who came to institute the political reforms and oversee the rebuilding of the wall, whereas Ezra was the one who came to oversee the religious reforms. Again, a lot of people would refer to Ezra as being the father of modern Judaism and defining Judaism in terms of being a religion of the book. There are references in the book of Nehemiah which indicate that when Ezra came down, he read the law of Moses, which, again, a lot of scholars would say that must be the Pentateuch, and perhaps Ezra himself was the person who was responsible for editing or compiling or at least preserving the Pentateuch during the exilic period. In any case, he comes to Jerusalem, reads the Pentateuch. Interestingly enough, he reads it and has it interpreted to the people. By this time, it appears that Aramaic, which was the official language of the Persian Empire, had been adopted by most Jews, both those living in Jerusalem and those who had been in Babylon, so that when the Hebrew was read to them, they didn't understand it anymore. It had to be interpreted into Aramaic at that time. Certainly we know from the time of Ezra and Nehemiah, Aramaic, rather than Hebrew, was the language of the common person in Palestine. In fact, Jesus, his first language, would have also been Aramaic rather than Hebrew. Hebrew, that, from that point on, became more or less an ecclesiastical language, just as in the Catholic Church, Latin has remained an ecclesiastical language for church use, but not really a living language. The reform of Ezra seems to have placed a lot of emphasis on the Pentateuch. Certainly the prophetic books by this point were being circulated. It doesn't appear that the prophetic canon, those books that came to be considered authoritative, were as of yet finally determined. But in any case, the reform was propagated on the Pentateuch, and was characterized by a fairly rigid legalism, emphasis being placed on the fact that not only were Jews not allowed to intermarry with people of other extractions, Moabites, Babylonians, and so forth, but even going to the extent of saying that if you're married to a Moabite, you have to divorce your wife according to the law of God. And again, at this point, most people would see Judaism turning in on itself, whereas before it had been more open to proselytizing and more of a missionary-type attitude. And this is the point at which two books may have been written. One is the Book of Ruth, which may possibly have been produced as a polemic against the reforms of Ezra, saying that you say that it's against the law of God to forbid your life, a Jew, to marry somebody from outside. We'll look at our famous ancestor Ruth, who was the grandmother of King David. It may also be that the Book of Jonah was produced around this time, emphasizing the fact that Judaism should not be simply concerned with maintaining its own religious purity, but that Yahweh was concerned about people like the Assyrians, who were the absolute arch enemy of ancient Israel. And that, again, a rather humorous story about how Yahweh sends Jonah out to preach to the Ninevites, the Assyrians, even though Jonah himself absolutely doesn't want to go unless it's Yahweh. Whether or not those two books were produced at that time, you could certainly imagine them being used by those who opposed Ezra's reform as an argument that historically Israelite religion, Hebrew religion, had not been as exclusivistic as Judaism is now becoming. Another interesting phenomenon that you find in the book of Nehemiah, especially, is mention of a certain family, Tobiah. Tobiah is said to be an Ammonite slave, probably meaning not that he was an actual peasant, that he was a slave of some Ammonite, but rather that he was probably a tax collector for the Persians living in Ammon. If you've been out to Iraq El Amir, if you follow my directions, you probably didn't get it. As you approach Iraq El Amir, on the right-hand side, you'll see caves with an Aramaic inscription, which, from the style of the inscription, most scholars would date to around 400 BC, roughly the same time as Nehemiah, and it says Tobiah. What's interesting about that is the fact that in the second chapter, in the 13th chapter of Nehemiah, Nehemiah refers to a family by the name of Tobiah who is living in Ammon, or in this vicinity, and who is causing him a lot of problems. The actual name Tobiah, which in ancient Hebrew means Yahweh is good, indicates that this family probably were Yahwist, or of that extraction, whether they had participated in the exile. Doubtless they were probably Jews, either from the south or maybe Israelites from the north, who had come into Ammon and got into the service of the Persian Empire, or emperor, and served as a tax collector. The way in which the Persians collected taxes was not to go out and tax each person individually, but it would be to put the office of tax collector up for bids, and the highest bidder would get the job. Say if you said, okay, I'll give you $10,000 this next year. All the Persians would demand then of that highest bidder is that they get $10,000 out of that person. Whereas the person, in this case Tobiah, could go around all the peasants and collect as much money in taxes as he wanted, because that's where it became a very profitable business. The Ptolemies, after the Persians seemed to have continued this particular thing. So, Tobiah probably was in the favor of the Persians, probably fairly unpopular with the people in this area, and certainly he was unpopular with the people in Jerusalem, with Nehemiah. And the book of Nehemiah talks about Tobiah making fun of Nehemiah's efforts to try to rebuild the city walls, saying you better make it high enough so that a fox can't jump over it and so forth. It evidently wasn't a very substantial wall, but at least it turned out finally to be large enough to protect the city. It also appears that Tobiah, certainly from chapter 13 of the book of Nehemiah, that he had influential relatives in Jerusalem and was probably vying for power, vying for control of Jerusalem, as was another fellow by the name of Sanballat, who was in Samaria at the same time, also harassing the people of Jerusalem. So there was this kind of three-way competition going on, with Nehemiah trying to fortify Jerusalem, Ezra trying to carry out his religious reforms, whereas the Samaritans were trying to slow up progress as much as possible, not only because of the religious slap in the face they got for not being allowed to participate in rebuilding the temple, but during the Babylonian exile, the Samaritans had extended their influence down into Judea. So when they saw the exiles coming back, obviously they felt that they were losing territory that they had gained in the course of the Babylonian period. So, as far as the archaeological evidence from the Persian period, it is very, very scanty, at least in Transjordan. I would venture to say that it's the least known period archaeologically in the history of Jordan. There is very, very few archaeological remains. You do find a few sherds of Persian pottery, and obviously the country was not totally abandoned, but in most of the surveys that are conducted throughout the country, very little Persian pottery is found. Very few Persian mummies are found in archaeological tells, and if they are, they generally aren't that deep. I'd be interested, Ted, in your recent survey, did you find much or any Persian pottery? That seems to be typical, certainly.
Is there any place where you will find it?
Well, Al says no. Again, the most important site, I would say, at this point, would be Iraq al-Amir. Certainly there you do have, with the inscription, evidence of Persian occupation. Although even that is not as sure as you might think. I mean, we think that that Tobiah family is the same Tobiah that's mentioned in the biblical text at the time of Nehemiah. Also, the Zenon text, Egypt, around 200 BC, refers to the Tobiah family living in this area, and that's probably a continuation of the same family. But since we do know the family existed there right up until the time of the construction of the Kasr al-Abed, around 175 BC, it is conceivable that those Tobiah inscriptions are in fact much later than that. They could conceivably be Hellenistic. They're dated mainly on the style of the writing and the fact that they must be associated with the biblical text, which isn't actually the same. As far as theological influence in the Old Testament and something that carries through in the New Testament, I think the most important is probably the whole doctrines and ideas that surrounds angelology, or the doctrine of angels. You find in the later books like the later prophecies, certainly the book of Daniel, that angels and archangels play a very important role. That, most people would say, comes from Iranian Persian influence during the Persian period. If you look carefully at the earlier sections of the Old Testament, you certainly have mention of divine messengers. But if you think about the patriarchal stories, for instance, all the messengers that come to see Abraham and so forth, they always come in human form. They're not recognizable as being anything but humans, even though they may be divine beings of some kind in disguise. But you certainly don't have the idea of angels going around with wings and ascending and descending until this Persian period. And then again, that is carried into the New Testament, certainly, with the appearance of angels to the Persians. But it does seem to be quite a development, quite a difference from the human-like messengers that appear in the earlier sections of the Old Testament. Okay. Getting in then to the so-called Hellenistic period, with the rise of Alexander the Great, who in 332 takes over Syria, Palestine, Transjordan, as well as Egypt, and then proceeds on to invade Persia the following year. Alexander the Great died very young, I think before his 33rd birthday or something like that, and immediately his kingdom was divided up among his generals. Evidently that was a fairly, relatively speaking, peaceful process. The eastern end of the Hellenistic Empire was divided between two generals, one Seleucus, who got the northern section of Mesopotamia and Syria and established his capital at Antioch, which should be right in here. Today that's just north of the, well, it depends on what it says. They're just north of the Syrian border, although the Syrians would say, no, it's just south of the Turkish border. That's a very contested area in both countries. And in any case, he established one capital here and then another capital over by Babylon. Took the northern section, and the Ptolemy established his realm in Egypt. The original agreement was that Seleucus would get Palestine, this area, under his authority. But at the last minute, Ptolemy was able to outmaneuver Seleucus. And in fact, from the time of the death of Alexander to around 200 BC, Palestine, Transjordan, remained under the influence of the Ptolemies, Ptolemy rulers, who were based in Egypt. Alexander the Great, besides extending his influence militarily, was very missionary-minded when it came to the spread of Greek culture. He had the idea of trying to spread Greek culture and religion throughout the world. And one of the ideas, the schemes he had, was to implant certain Greek cities throughout the empire, which would serve as centers of Greek culture and religion. In this part of the world, he did that with the so-called Decapolis cities, or at least the generals who followed him did that. And here in Jordan, you've got the city of Amman. In some cases, these Greek cities, again, it's not really proper to refer to them as the Decapolis cities yet. They're not called cities of the Decapolis until the Roman period. But these Greek cities sometimes were founded on already existing cities, such as here in Amman, which had been occupied for thousands of years. The name was changed to Philadelphia. Other cities like Jerash were probably started from scratch. Gadara or Gadara, in the north modern case, was another Greek center of influence. Pella in the Jordan Valley. Scythopolis, which is ancient Bashan, on the other side of the river. It's the only Greek, what later became a city of the Decapolis that was to the west of the Jordan River. Tel Hussein may well have been in the capital city, but we don't know for sure.
What is that?
Tel Hussein? It's this mammoth tell that you find up in the modern village of Hussein, which is maybe 14, 15 kilometers southeast of the river. As you go to the University of Yarmouk, you go right through this little village with a big tell. I should mention the fact that these Decapolis cities were really a thorn in the flesh, especially for the conservative Semites, among them, of course, being the conservative Jews in Jerusalem, because they were promoting Greek culture and religion, which were considered by the conservatives as intrusive. And you find throughout the Ptolemaic period, although the Ptolemaic rulers were pretty decent, as long as people stayed in line, they weren't too hard on. But still you find a growing reaction among the conservative Jewish community reacting against Hellenization, modernization. They're becoming much more reactionary religiously and also nationalistically. And I think that's where we'll stop. So we'll take up next time with the rise of the Seleucid Empire, or at least their domination of the Maccabean Revolt.
What more sessions do we have?